To my right, aluminum walkers were bunched together like grocery carts outside a supermarket. The day's menu was posted on the wall, behind glass like a painting on exhibit. Saturday lunch consisted of a ground chicken patty, creamed corn, lettuce, tomato, fruit cup, and an oatmeal cookie. In my world, the lettuce and tomato might appear as a restaurant garnish, a decorative element to be ignored by the diner, left behind on the plate to be thrown in the trash. Here, the lettuce and tomato were given equal billing, as though part of a lavish nutritional feast. I thought about fries and a QP with cheese and nearly fled the premises. French doors opened into the dining room where I could see the residents at lunch. Even at a glance, I noted three times more women than men in evidence. Some wore street clothes, but the majority were still dressed in their robes and slippers, not bedridden but confined by their convalescent status. Many turned to stare at me, not rudely, but with a touching air of expectation. Had I come for a visit? Was I there to take them home? Was I someone's long-overdue daughter or niece, proposing an outing in the clean, fresh air? I found myself glancing away, embarrassed I was offering nothing in the way of personal contact. Sheepishly, I looked back, raised my hand, and waved. A tentative chorus of hands rose in response as my greeting was returned. Their smiles were so sweet and forgiving, I felt pricked with gratitude. I backed away from the dining room and crossed the hall. A second set of doors stood open, revealing a day room, currently empty, furnished with mismatched couches, upholstered chairs, a piano, two television sets, and a cluster of game tables. The floors were done in a glossy beige linoleum, the walls painted a restful shade of robin's egg blue. The ready-made drapes were a blend of yellow, blue, and green, in a vaguely floral pattern. Countless throw pillows had been needle-pointed, cross-stitched, quilted, and crocheted. Perhaps a clutch of church ladies had been afflicted by a fit of stitchery. One pillow had a saying embroidered across the face, "You're only as old as you feel," a disheartening thought given some of the residents I'd seen. Metal folding chairs were stacked against the near wall for quick assembling. Everything was clean, but the decorating was generic, budget-driven, falling somehow short of good taste. I walked past the front desk, which was located in a small alcove, and cruised down the corridor, guided by signs indicating the services of a dietary supervisor, a nursing supervisor, and a clutch of occupational, speech, and physical therapists. All three doors were open, but the offices were empty and the lights had been doused. Across the hall, I saw a sign for admissions. That door was closed, and a casual try of the knob told me it was locked. Next door was medical records, which apparently shared space with administration. I thought I'd start there. The overhead lights were on, and I moved through the door. There was no one in evidence. I waited at the counter, idly staring at the wire basket filled with incoming mail. Casually, I surveyed my surroundings. Two desks back-to-back, one with a computer, the other with an electric typewriter humming faintly. There were numerous rolling file carts, a copy machine, and metal file cabinets on the far wall. There was also a big clock with a clicking second hand I could hear from 15 feet away. Still no one. I rested my elbow on the counter, dangling my fingers near the basket full of mail. By fanning the corners and tilting my head, I could read most of the return addresses. Bills, the usual, gas and electric, a lawn and gardening service, two manila envelopes from Santa Teresa Hospital, better known as St. Terry's.
"Can I help you?"
Startled, I straightened up and said, "Hi, how are you?" The young woman had emerged from the door connecting administration to medical records. She wore glasses with red plastic frames. Her complexion was clear, but she looked like she'd suffer a contagion of zits at the least provocation. Her hair was a medium brown in several irregular lengths, a layered cut grown out now and badly in need of a trim. Under her green smock, she wore brown polyester pants. The name Mary and Pacific Meadows were machine-embroidered on the breast pocket above her heart. She crossed to the counter, passing through a hinged door, and took her place on the far side. At first glance, I thought she was in her early 30s, but I quickly revised that downward by a good 10 years. She wore metal braces on her teeth, and whatever she'd eaten for lunch was still embedded in the wires. Her breath smelled of tension and discontent. Her expression remained quizzical, but her tone had an edge.
Can I ask what you were doing?
I blinked one eye in her direction. I lost my contact lens. It might have popped out in the car. I only noticed it just now. I thought it might have fallen in the basket, but there's no sign of it.
Oh, want me to help you look?
Don't worry about it. I have a whole box of them at home.
Are you here to see someone?
I'm here on business, I said. I removed my wallet from my shoulder bag and flipped it open. I pointed at my PI license. I've been hired to look into Dr. Purcell's disappearance. Mary squinted at my license, holding up the postage stamp-sized photo for comparison with my face-sized face. I said, "Are you the office manager?" She shook her head.
"I'm temping here on weekends while the other girl's out on maternity leave, Monday through Fridays. I'm Mrs. Stegler's assistant."
"Really? Well, that's great. And what does that entail?" "You know, typing, filing. I answer phones and distribute mail to all the residents, whatever needs doing." "Is Mrs. Stegler the one I should be talking to?"
"I guess. She's acting associate administrator. Unfortunately, she won't be back until Monday. Can you stop by then?"
"What about Mr. Glazer or Mr. Brodus?"
"They have an office downtown."
"Gee, that's too bad. I was driving through the neighborhood and took a chance." "Well, I guess it can't be helped." I saw her gaze stray to her computer.
"Could you excuse me a minute?"
"Go right ahead." She moved around to her 12-inch monitor with its amber print on the black. She was probably using office hours to do her personal correspondence. She pressed keys until she backed out of the document. She returned to the counter, smiling self-consciously.
"You have a business card? I can have Mrs. Stegler call you as soon as she gets in."
"That'd be great." I took my time fumbling through my handbag to find a business card. "How long have you been here?"
3 months, December 1st. I'm still on probation.
I put my card on the counter. "You like the work?"
"Sort of, but not really. You know, it's boring, but okay. Mrs. S. has been here forever, and she started out just like me. Not that I'll stick around as long as she has. I'm 2 semesters short of my college degree."
"What field?"
"Elementary ed. My dad says you shouldn't job hop because it really looks bad on your resume. Like you're shiftless or something, which I've never been."
"Well, yeah, but on the other hand, if you're interested in teaching, there's no point hanging on to a job that doesn't suit."
"That's what I said. Besides, Mrs. S. is real moody and gets on my nerves. One day she's sweet, like butter wouldn't melt in her mouth, and then she turns around and acts all crabby. I mean, what is her problem?"
"What's your guess?"
"Beats me. They're still looking for someone to fill the position, which gritches her butt good. She thinks she should be promoted instead of just being used, is how she put it."
"If she did get promoted, who would she replace?"
"Mrs. Delacorte. She's the one who got canned."
I kept my expression neutral. Not only was she bored, but she hadn't learned the basic rules, the most compelling of which is never, never, never confide company secrets in the likes of me. I said, "Golly, that's too bad. Why was she fired, has anybody said?" My lies and fake behavior are usually heralded by gollies and gees.
"She wasn't fired exactly. It's more like she was laid off."
"Oh, right, and when was that?"
"The same time as Mrs. Bart. She's the bookkeeper since way back when. They were interviewing for her position the same time I applied for this one."
"How come?"
"How come what?"
"I wonder how the bookkeeper and the administrator got laid off at the same time. Was that coincidence?"
"Not at all," she said. "Mrs. Bart was let go, and Mrs. Delacorte got upset and raised a stink. Mr. Harrington suggested she might be happier finding work somewhere else, so that's what she did. This is all stuff I heard."
She stopped what she was saying, and her eyes seemed to widen behind the red plastic frames.
"You're not taking notes. I'm not supposed to gossip. Mrs. S. is hell on that."
I held up my hands. I'm just making conversation till the rain lets up. She patted her chest.
Whew! For a minute I got nervous. I wouldn't want you to get the wrong impression. I mean, it's like I told her, I'd never blab anybody's private business. It's not in my nature.
You and me both, I said. So, who's Mr. Harrington? I never heard of him.
He works for the billing company in Santa Maria.
And he's the one who hired you?
Kind of. He interviewed me by phone, but only after Mrs. S. had already approved my application. That's the way it works around here. Make the guys think they're in charge when we're really the ones who do everything.
I thought Dr. Purcell did all the hiring and firing.
I don't know anything about that. I was here less than 2 weeks when he, you know, ran off or whatever. I think that's why Mr. Harrington was forced to step in.
Where's Mrs. Delacorte work now, has anybody said?
She's over at St. Terry's. I know because last week she stopped by to visit with Mrs. S. Turns out she found a great job, so it's worked out fine. Getting laid off can be a blessing, though it didn't seem like it at the time, is what she says.
What about Mrs. Bart?
I don't know where she went.
Did you know Dr. Purcell?
I knew who he was, but that's about it. That's his office in there. He just, like, you know, vanished. It really gives me the creeps.
Weird. I wonder what went on.
No telling. The whole staff's upset. All the residents adored him. He made sure everybody got a card on their birthday and stuff like that. He paid out of his own pocket just so all these pitiful old people would feel special.
Has anyone made a guess about what happened to him?
It's all they talked about at first. I mean, not me so much because I hardly knew him.
What kind of thing? I could see Mary wrestle with her conscience, deliberating a good 7 seconds before she who never blabs leaned toward me.
Promise you won't repeat this?
I won't even say it once. She lowered her voice.
Mrs. S. thinks he left the country.
I lowered my voice, too. Because of...
Medicare.
Oh, that's right. Someone mentioned that before, but I didn't have a chance to ask.
Meaning what?
She said,
F-R-A-U-D. Last winter, the O-I-G.
O-I-G?
Oh, that's the Office of Inspector General. They're part of the Department of Health and Human Services. Anyway, O-I-G faxed us this list of charts and billing records they wanted to see. Mrs. S. said at first Dr. Purcell didn't think anything of it. They do that sometimes just to keep you on your toes. But then they came back, and he figured out how serious it was. He kept going over the information to see how it had looked to them. Not good. Up to his lower lip in poop, to coin her phrase.
Is that why he'd been working late the last couple of months?
Well, yeah.
So the place is under investigation?
Big time. It started as a desk audit. They wanted a bunch of stuff covering the past 2 years. That's when Dr. P came in as the medical director. I mean, he's that and administrator, with a hyphen in between. The way Mrs. S. tells it, if Pacific Meadows loses its funding, the place will be shut down. Not to mention all the penalties, you know, fines and restitution. She says maybe even jail time, plus the public embarrassment.
The Purcells are like this big-time la-di-da social couple, so you can imagine the disgrace. Dr. P. was the one lined up to take the brunt of it. Like, his butt's in a sling. Those are her words, not mine. What about his employers?
Oh, the other two don't have anything to do with the hands-on stuff. They're all over the state taking care of other business.
Well, that sounds scary for Dr. Purcell, I said.
I'd have died if it had been me.
I'll bet, I said. When did this first come up?
I think last January, way before my time. Then in March, these two guys from MFCU swooped in unannounced. That's the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. They came loaded with questions and a list of all the charts they wanted pulled. Everybody scrambled around, practically wetting their pants. Dr. P was notified of this big list of violations and a lot of questionable claims, meaning P-H-O-N-Y. We're talking thousands of dollars, half a million at least, and that's just scratching the surface. He could turn out to be a major big-time crook. I'm surprised it didn't hit the papers. Mrs. S. says they'll keep a lid on it till they see what they've got. Meantime, they're breathing down his neck, and they mean business. So she thinks he bolted to avoid punishment? Well, I sure would if I was in his place. How do you know it was him? Other people must have had access to billing records. Maybe that's why the bookkeeper was laid off, I said. She leaned forward and lowered her gaze. You won't mention this, you swear? Cross your heart. I crossed my heart and held up my hand. Mrs. Dorner, she's director of staff development. She thinks Dr. P. could have been kidnapped, snatched in the parking lot to keep him quiet. I said, wow, and made a skeptical face. Unfortunately, the cops say there's no real evidence of that. It wouldn't take much. Slap tape on his mouth, throw him in the trunk, and take off, she said. They could have used his own car, which is why it hasn't been found. I saw Mary's look as she began to busy herself, fussing with the mail. That's a very good point. I glanced over my shoulder. A nurse in a white uniform was standing in the doorway. She had fixed us with a look that was both shrewd and intimidating. I cleared my throat and said, well, Mary, I better scoot and let you get back to work. I'll stop back on Monday and chat with Mrs. Stegler. I'll tell her you were here. The nurse turned and looked at me as I passed through the doorway within inches of her. I repressed the urge to shudder once my back was turned, wondering exactly how much she'd heard. At the entrance, I retrieved my slicker and took a moment to reassemble myself in rain garb. When I emerged from the nursing home, the rain had slowed to a drizzle, and a mist seemed to float on the tarmac like smoke. The eaves still dripped water at irregular intervals. I bypassed a puddle and crossed the parking lot to the slot I'd taken. I could see now, with fresh eyes, that the name newly painted out at the foot of the parking space was P. Delacorte. Once in my car, I opened the pack of index cards and started taking notes, one fact per card, until I'd emptied my brain. I couldn't help wondering why Crystal and or the cops hadn't mentioned this fraud business when I'd talked to them. Chapter 7. After I left Pacific Meadows, I stopped by Kingman and Ives and let myself in the side door. I went into my office and peeled off my slicker, which I hung on my coat tree. Happily for me, the place felt deserted despite the fact there were lights on in most of the offices. The Saturday morning cleaning crew had come and gone. Waste baskets had been emptied. The air was scented with pledge, and I could see rows of fresh vacuum cleaner tracks on the burnt orange carpeting. The quiet was divine. Briefly, I conjured up an image of the new one-person office on Floresta Street. I was already feeling competitive with the other prospective tenants. I pulled out my portable Smith Corona and placed it on my desk. I sat down in my swivel chair and took out the file I'd opened. I sorted through the notes I'd assembled, adding the information on the index cards. Looming large in my mind was Fiona's return on Tuesday. I could already see her, arms crossed, one foot tapping with impatience, while I brought her up to date. She'd have dollar signs dancing like sugar plums above her head, thinking, $50 an hour for this? My strategy was to outfox the woman by presenting a beautifully constructed, typewritten report that would make it look like I'd done a lot more than drive around chatting with folks. What I labored under was the burdensome sense of Fiona's disapproval, knowing she begrudged me every nickel I spent. Even if her original display of irritation had been pure manipulation, I could feel the sting of her whip on my neck. I tried not to dwell on the notion that I should have declined the job when I had the chance. I focused my attention on the business at hand. It took me an hour to sketch out a rough draft. I typed it and did some editing, revising it twice. I kept my language neutral, being careful to avoid drawing conclusions from what I'd learned so far. I also omitted much of what Crystal had said. I was being paid to find Dow, not to tattle to Fiona and his second wife. When I was satisfied the document was as polished as I could make it, I typed the new draft. Then I got out my calculator and added up my hours. How long had I spent with Detective Odessa?
I tapped with my pencil on my front teeth. Really, it was 20 minutes max, which I rounded out to half an hour. Didn't want Fiona thinking I'd shortchanged her with the cops. Let's see, I'd spent almost 2 hours with Crystal, and I added another hour to cover my morning visit to Pacific Meadows. I eyeballed the numbers. So far, I'd only earned $175 out of the $1,500 she'd paid me up front, which meant I still owed her $1,325 worth of my life. At this rate, I'd never be out from under. Oh, well. I typed the invoice and attached it to the original of my report, then placed the copies in the folder. I stood up and stretched, working the kinks out of my neck with a head roll or two. Feeling restless, I wandered down the inner corridor, peering into offices along the way. As I passed Lonnie's office, I was startled to catch sight of him. He sat tilted back in his swivel chair, his feet propped up on the edge of his desk. A transcript in his lap, apparently catching up on work while the office was quiet and the phones were silent. In lieu of the usual dress shirt and suit, he wore a plaid flannel shirt and a pair of stonewashed jeans. His concentration was complete, a focus that caused his whole body to become still. I watched him reach for his pencil and underline a phrase, soft scratching in the quiet. Lonnie looked like a boxer, his body dense and muscular, his nose thickened by scars. His hair is dark and unruly, growing in all directions. I've seen newborns like that, with a head of hair so thick and unexpected it seems comical. He's a man of high energy, generally souped up on vitamins, coffee, nutritional supplements, and competitive drive. This was probably as relaxed as I'd ever seen him. Lonnie? He glanced up and smiled, tossing his pencil aside.
Kinsey, come on in. I've been wondering what you were up to. I haven't seen you for weeks.
Not much. I didn't even know you were here. The place has been so quiet, I thought I was alone. Catching up on work?
Sure, but it's just an excuse. Marie's out of town. Some convention of butt-kickers down in San Diego. Tell you the truth, I'd rather be here than stuck by myself at home. Have a seat, he said. What about you? What brings you in on a Saturday afternoon?
I was typing up some notes while things were fresh on my mind. Oh, hey, before I forget, a guy named Richard Heavener may be calling to check my references.
What's the deal?
I think I found office space, but I'm waiting to see. I filled him in on the situation, describing the newly renovated cottage with its redwood deck. It's great, small and quiet, and the location's perfect.
If he calls, I promise I'll sing your praises. I won't say a word about the tiny bit of time you spent incarcerated. Meantime, the door's always open if it doesn't work out.
I appreciate that. Cross your fingers for me.
Not a problem, he said. Ida Ruth tells me you're working on Dr. Purcell's disappearance.
How'd she hear that? I only took the job yesterday. Lonnie waved a hand in the air.
Ida Ruth knows everything. She makes a point of it. Actually, she has a friend who used to work for him. Current speculation has it he's run away from home. Days when I think about doing that myself.
Oh, please. Marie would come after you and hunt you down like a dog. His wife was a martial arts instructor, an expert in ways to cripple people with her size 5 bare feet.
Oh, there is that. Of course, the problem with disappearing is you can't do it on impulse, not if you're serious. Takes long-term planning if you want to stay gone for good.
So you'd think. Personally, I think he's dead. But his passport and $30,000 disappeared about the same time.
$30,000 would evaporate in 6 months. Purcell's accustomed to living well. He's not going to pinch pennies. At his age, he'd have to be nuts.
That was my reaction. On the other hand, if he settled in a third-world country, he could live pretty well on it. And if he ran short of funds, he could probably set up a small practice with no questions asked.
Why not just stay where he is?
I forgot to tell you the wrinkle I came across today. I filled him in on my visit to Pacific Meadows and the chat I had with Mary, the patron saint of loose lips. According to her, the federal fraudbusters are hot on his trail. $500,000 in bogus claims. Guilty or innocent, he might have taken off once he realized they were closing in. Lonnie winced with impatience.
Get serious. No way. The feds aren't going to put a guy like him in jail. The prosecutor has to prove criminal intent, and how's he going to do that? Believe me, Medicare regulations would drive any honest man insane. So you weasel the deal, claim coding errors and incompetent clerical help. They might fine him and wag a finger, but any good attorney could get him off. Hell, I could do it myself, and I don't know beans about that stuff. First thing you do is bore the hell out of the jury, put up a bunch of charts and graphs, citing statistics till 9 out of the 12 start nodding off. Suggest the old doc's gone senile or he's a poor businessman. He paused with a snort of amusement. You hear about that case? Some guy up in Fresno got acquitted because a jury decided he was too dumb to be guilty of embezzlement. His own attorney painted him as such a buffoon, the jury took pity and cut the poor dunce loose. Purcell's in no danger.
Yeah, but did he know that? And what about the public disgrace?
Nobody cares about those things in this day and age.
Lonnie picked up his pencil and drew a box on his legal pad.
One thing you're forgetting. If the guy's smart, say he's ripped off the system to the tune of $500,000, which is probably conservative, all they know about so far, call it $2 million just to make it worth the risk. A smart guy makes 2, maybe 3 trips abroad, picks a country where he knows he can count on extradition laws if the feds track him down. He sets up a bank account and feeds money in, transferring funds until he has what he needs. Then he can go on merrily cheating till someone's onto him. Situation heats up, he's on the first plane out. In that case, the $30,000 is just his travel fund.
I thought about Fiona's story of Dowan's vanishing twice without explanation. Good point. I was also thinking about the bookkeeper who got fired and the assistant administrator who quit her job in protest. Maybe that was Dow's attempt to point a finger elsewhere. The phone rang and Lonnie picked up the handset. From the nature of his comments, it was Marie checking in. I waved at him and eased out of his office, leaving him to finish his conversation in private. I returned to my office and reread my report. It seemed okay, but I thought I'd let it sit for a day. I'd be adding interviews once I figured out who I'd be talking to next. I drew up a list from possibilities I'd gleaned. Purcell's business associates were among the top 5 names, along with Dow's best friend. I made sure I had the necessary phone numbers and then decided I'd done enough, and it was time to go home. At 2 o'clock, I made myself some milk of tomato soup and a gooey grilled cheese sandwich that I dipped in my bowl and lifted dripping to my lips. The liquid red of the soup against the crunchy golden surface of the bread was a culinary portrait of early childhood consolation. Aunt Jin first served me this confection when I was 5 years old, mourning my parents who'd been killed in a car wreck the previous May. The ooze of melted Velveeta will always prompt the curious sensation of sorrow and satisfaction commingling on the surface of my tongue. This sandwich, I confess, was the highlight of my weekend, which is what life boils down to when you're celibate. Afterward, I did what any other trained professional investigator would do. I walked the 6 steps into the living room, flipped off my shoes, and settled on the sofa, where I covered myself in a big, puffy comforter and started reading a book. Within minutes, I'd been sucked through a wormhole into a fictional world, traveling faster than the speed of words into a realm without sound and without gravity. The phone rang, the sound annoyingly shrill. I'd sunk like a stone into a river of dreams, and I was disoriented by the need to surface. I reached back, fumbling for the phone, which was resting on the end table above my head. I hadn't even realized I'd fallen asleep, except for the drooling, which I don't ordinarily do when awake. Ms. Milhone? Yes. If this was someone selling something, I was going to say a very bad word. This is Blanche McKee. 3 seconds passed. The name meant nothing. I rubbed my face and said, Who? Fiona Purcell's daughter. I understand Mother's hired you. I just wanted you to know how relieved we all are. We've been urging her to do this ever since Daddy disappeared. Oh, right. Sorry, I couldn't place the name. How are you? Groggily, I sat up, pulling the quilt around me like a tribal robe. Fine, thanks. I hope I'm not calling at a bad time. I didn't wake you, did I?
Oh, not at all, I said. The truth is, everyone knows you've been sleeping, regardless of how earnestly you might lie to them. Blanche must have decided to take me at my word.
I'm not sure how much Mother's told you. Quite a lot, I'm sure. But if there's anything I can do, I'll be happy to help. Did she mention my friend Nancy?
I don't believe so. The name doesn't sound familiar.
I was afraid of that. Mother tends to be a cynic, which you might have guessed. Nancy's recently moved to Chico, but she's available for consultation any time by phone.
Nancy, good news. I'm making a note, whoever Nancy was.
I'm assuming you'll want my personal impressions as well.
Sure, I mean, eventually, that'd be great.
I'm so happy you said that, because I was thinking, if you have a minute this afternoon, you might want us to get together so I can share my concerns.
I hesitated. Ah, well, you know, at the moment I'm more interested in facts than impressions and concerns. No offense.
None taken. I didn't mean to imply that I don't have facts.
Uh-huh. I hadn't forgotten Fiona's barely disguised contempt for her younger daughter, mother of four, soon to be mother of five. On the other hand, maybe Fiona told Blanche about me in order to test my perseverance, since I'd made such a point of it during our meeting. Blanche said,
"What time would suit?"
I went ahead and mouthed the bad word, adding another choice expletive from my extensive collection. Hang on a second, I'll check my schedule. I held the receiver to my chest while I looked at my watch. 4:06. I allowed time to pass while I pretended to scan my day planner with its numerous Saturday afternoon appointments. I had no particular desire to meet Blanche, especially at the cost of a first-class nap. I hated the idea of abandoning my lair, and I certainly didn't want to traipse all over town on such a cold, damp day. My living room windows were already gray with a premature November twilight, and I could see the drizzle slant against the bare branches that were tapping at the panes. I glanced at my watch again. 4:07. I could hear Blanche breathing, and when she spoke, her tone was sharp.
"Kinsey, are you there?"
I'm here. Gee, it looks like I'm booked up today. Tomorrow might be possible. I could be there by 10 o'clock.
That won't work for me, and Monday's out of the question. Isn't there any way you could stop by? I feel it's terribly important.
What I personally felt was a surge of irritation. I could just see Fiona returning from San Francisco, carping because I hadn't taken time to interview Blanche.
$1,500 and you couldn't even bother to see my daughter?
I said, I could be there by 5:30, but only for half an hour. That's the best I can do.
Perfect. That's fine. We're up on Eden Side at the corner of Monterey Terrace. The number's 1236. It's a two-story Spanish. You'll see a dark blue station wagon parked in the drive.
Eden Side Road was part of a small housing development, cunningly tucked into the foothills, five winding streets, each of which ended in a wide cul-de-sac. The builder had followed the terrain, taking the path of least resistance. The five streets built into the contours of the hill like rivulets of asphalt flowing from the highest point. My progress was halting, an exasperating 10 miles an hour, as I slowed for a speed bump every 15 yards or so. The neighborhood was ideal for children, whose presence was announced by the number of strollers, playhouses, swing sets, bicycles, tricycles, big wheels, and skateboards littering the yards. It looked like a Toys R Us had exploded close by. The house at the corner of Edenside and Monterey Terrace was indeed a two-story Spanish hacienda, with a courtyard in front. Even in the gathering dark, I couldn't miss the three-car garage that jutted forward aggressively like a pugnacious jaw. As I watched, the low-voltage landscape lights came on, illuminating the front of the house. The exterior stucco was tinted a gaudy pink, and the roof tiles, while clay, were a series of interlocking orange S's, clearly mass-produced. The original clay tiles, still gracing many older structures in town, are now a dark, faded red, mottled with lichen and shaped like a C where the worker once laid the soft clay across his thigh in forming it.
As promised, there was a dark blue station wagon parked in the drive. I pulled in at the curb, got out, locked my car, and approached the house along a crushed granite walk. The surrounding landscape was drought-proofed. All gravel and concrete, scattered with assorted cacti and oversized succulents. I let myself in through a small iron gate and crossed the tile-paved courtyard. A mock Spanish fountain splashed water by way of a circulating pump. I rang the bell. I could hear shrieks, barking dogs, and the clattering of small feet as a pack of short folk battled for the honor of playing butler to me. As the door opened, a girl of perhaps 5 turned to sock the 4-year-old boy child behind her. Within seconds, fists were flailing, the children, red-faced and tearful, as they struggled for possession of the knob between shoves and kicks with brown, hard-soled shoes. Meanwhile, 2 hyperactive Jack Russell Terriers leaped up and down as though spring-loaded. The toddler bringing up the rear got knocked on his diaper and set up a howl. Another girl, her back turned, was walking down the hallway toward the rear of the house, bellowing, "Mom! Mommy! Heather's socking Josh, and the dog's just not quitting on his behind." "Amanda, what did I tell you about whining? Josh can take care of himself. Now please mind your own business and quit tattling, or you will drive me insane." Sway-backed, Blanche lumbered into sight. The sphere of her belly, so large it looked a rogue moon, held in orbit by unseen gravitational forces. Her maternity outfit was a pale gray washable silk, palazzo pants, a long tunic with tricky buttons and flaps. I was guessing that when the babe came, she'd be able to plop a boob out and feed the little tyke on demand. She had long blonde hair, the strands fine and glossy, reaching almost to her waist. Her porcelain complexion was tinted a pale peach. Blue eyes, high forehead, finely arched brows. She looked like a Storyland princess from a book of Grimm's fairy tales, except great with child. She swooped down and gathered up the howling baby, whom she settled on her hip. She grabbed Heather by the arm, hauling her away from her brother, and then giving her a push along the corridor. "You kids go out in the backyard. Amanda's going to make you some peanut butter crackers. You can have a snack out there. Just don't eat too many. We're having supper in a bit. Now scoot. I mean it. Everybody go on outside." "Mom, it's dark." "Well, turn the porch light on." "But we want to watch cartoons." "Too bad. You do what I say, and no running," Blanche warned. Heather and Josh were already pounding down the hall, but they slowed to a power walk, knocking and bumping each other. The dogs followed, barking, while Amanda veered off into the kitchen to make peanut butter crackers without an audible complaint. Amanda, who couldn't have been much more than 7 years old, was already being cast in the role of secondary mom. While Blanche was issuing orders, she managed to jiggle the crying baby, and his howls had subsided. She turned and labored toward the family room, with me tagging along behind her as well as I could. There were toys everywhere. In order to avoid crushing plastic underfoot, I had to shuffle, making a path through the Legos strewn on the floor in front of me. A wooden gate had been secured across the stairs to the second floor, and what I assumed was the basement door had a hook-and-eye closure to prevent kidlets from tumbling headlong into the yawning abyss. "Ever the optimist," I said. "Your mother mentioned a nanny." "She isn't here on weekends, and Andrew's currently out of town." "What sort of work does he do?" "He's an attorney, mergers and acquisitions. He's in Chicago until Wednesday."
"When's the new baby due?"
"Technically, not for 3 weeks yet, but he'll probably come early. All the other ones have." In the family room, a toy chest stood open, its contents flung in every direction. Dolls, teddy bears, a bright yellow school bus filled with brightly painted spool kids with round painted heads. There was a wooden bench and mallet for pounding wooden pegs, crayons, picture books, tinker toys, small metal cars, a wooden train. A playpen had been erected in the center of the room. I spotted a mechanical swing, a circular walker with surrounding rubber bumpers, a high chair, an infant seat, and a portable crib. Every wall socket in view had been blanked out by plastic inserts. There was nothing on any surface below sea level. Every breakable object removed to a high shelf, as though in preparation for a coming flood. From outside, I could hear a piercing shriek go up, this at a higher decibel level than the earlier shrieking in the hall. Amanda started screaming, "Mommy! Mom! Heather pushed Josh off the jungle gym, and he has blood coming out of his nose!" Blanche said, "Oh, Lord, here, take him." Without pausing, she handed off the baby like a forward pass and waddled into the kitchen. Quentin was surprisingly heavy, his bones dense as stone. He watched his mother depart, and then his eyes moved to mine. Though Quentin was as yet incapable of speech, I could see the concept monster forming in his underdeveloped brain. The enormity of his plight began to dawn on him, and he pursed his small mouth in advance of a round of howls. I called, "Can I put him in his playpen?" "No, he hates that," she yelled as she went out the back door. The screaming in the yard was taken up by a second child, apparently vying for equal time. As if in response, Quentin's mouth came open in a cry so deep-seated he made no sound at first. He curled his body inward while he gathered his strength. Without warning, he flung himself outward like a diver in the midst of a backflip. He might have torn himself entirely out of my grasp if I hadn't grabbed him and swung him up from the floor. I said, "Whee!" as though the two of us were really having fun. The look on his face suggested otherwise. I tried jiggling him as she had, but that only made matters worse. Now I was not only a monster, but a monster baby jiggler, intent on shaking him to death. I walked around in a circle saying, "There, there, there." The child was not soothed. Finally, in desperation, I lowered him into the playpen, forcing his stiff legs to bend until he was fully seated. I handed him two alphabet blocks and a part of a half-eaten soda cracker. The howling ceased at once. He put the cracker in his mouth and banged the letter P against the plastic padding under him. I stood up, patting myself on the chest while I moved into the kitchen to see what was happening. Blanche was just banging through the back door with 4-year-old Josh on her hip, his legs hanging way past her knees. I could see a lump on his forehead the size of an egg, and copious blood on his upper lip. One-handed, she dampened a kitchen towel, opened the freezer, and took out some ice cubes, which she wrapped in the towel and pressed against his head. She carried him into the family room and sank into a chair. The minute she sat down, he worked his way through a flap in her tunic and began to nurse. Taken aback, I averted my eyes. I thought kids his age had been 12 steps out of that. She indicated a nearby chair, paying him not the slightest attention as he suckled her right breast. I glanced down at the chair and removed a half-consumed peanut butter and jelly sandwich before I settled on the edge. Josh's medical emergency apparently entitled all of the children to escape the chill and dark outside. The next thing I knew, a cartoon show blasted from the TV set. Heather and Amanda sat cross-legged on the floor, and Josh joined them moments later, holding the towel-wrapped ice cubes to his head. I tried to concentrate on what Blanche was saying, but all I could think about was that, even at my age, a tubal ligation probably wasn't out of the question. Chapter 8. I glanced at my watch, a gesture that wasn't lost on her.
"I know you're in a hurry, so I'll get to the point. Has Mother filled you in on Crystal's past?"
"I know she was a stripper before she married your dad."
"I'm not talking about that. Did she mention Crystal's 14-year-old daughter was born out of wedlock?"
I waited, wondering at the relevance. I leaned forward, not from avid interest, but because the whistles, bangs, and manic music from the television set were loud enough to cause permanent hearing loss.
I watched Blanche's lips move, putting the sentences together belatedly like the subtitles on a foreign film. "I'm not even sure Crystal knows who the father is. Then she married Lloyd somebody and had another child by him. That boy died when he was 18 months old, an accidental drowning. This was 4 or 5 years ago." I squinted. "And you think this is somehow connected to your father's disappearance?"
She seemed startled.
"Well, no, but you said you wanted all the facts.
I wanted to fill in the picture so you could see what you're up against.
Meaning what?
A commercial came on. The sound ratcheted up a notch so the little children who lived across the street wouldn't miss the pitch for a vitamin-rich cereal that was supposed to look and taste like licorice.
Blanche was saying, "Doesn't Crystal's behavior strike you as odd?"
I was largely lip-reading by now, and her comment had gone completely over my head. "Blanche, could we turn down the sound on the television set?"
"Sorry."
She reached for the remote control and muted the sound. The silence was heaven. The children continued to sit on the floor, arranged in front of the set as though gathered around a campfire. Frantic images danced across the screen, in colors so vivid they left an afterimage if I glanced away. Blanche returned to her commentary.
"I don't know about you, but Crystal doesn't seem at all distraught about what's happened. She's cool as can be, which seems inappropriate to me."
It has been 9 weeks. I don't think anyone can be distraught for that long.
Defenses kick in. You manage to adjust or you go insane. "I just think it's interesting that Crystal's never made a public appeal for information about Daddy. She's never offered a reward. She's never sent out any flyers. No psychics have been consulted."
That caught me up short. "You think a psychic would help?"
"It wouldn't hurt," she said. "My friend Nancy's uncanny. She has this amazing, quite incredible gift."
"She's a psychic? Is that why she's offering to consult with me on the phone?"
"Of course. When I lost my diamond ring, she was able to pinpoint the exact location."
"How'd she do that? I'm really curious."
"It's hard to describe. She said she smelled something sweet. She saw glimpses of white, maybe something nautical. She did two separate readings, for lack of a better word, and the images were the same. Then I realized the last time I remembered seeing the ring, I'd taken it off to wash my hands at the bathroom sink. I'd already searched that area half a dozen times. As it turned out, I'd set the ring in the soap dish, and it was embedded on the underside of the soap, which is exactly what she smelled."
I said, "What was the white part? Was that the bathroom sink?"
"Not in that bathroom. The sink is hunter green in there, but the soap was white."
"Got it. What was the nautical part?"
Blanche's tone was defensive.
"Not everything's literal. Some of the images she sees are metaphorical, you know, associative."
"Nautical. Faucet water?" I suggested gamely.
"The point is, Nancy's offered to consult with Crystal, but she refuses to cooperate.
Maybe she doesn't believe in psychics."
"But Nancy's fabulous, I swear."
"How much does she charge?"
"Oh, she doesn't want money. Ordinarily, she does, but this is strictly out of friendship with me."
"Why does Crystal have to be involved? Can't Nancy do a reading and simply tell you what she sees?"
"She has to have access to the house so she can pick up on Daddy's vibes, his psychic energy. I took her over to his office and let her sit in his chair. She keeps getting this picture of him approaching a house and going through the front door. Then nothing. This has to be Crystal's beach property because she visualizes sand."
"Could be the desert." Blanche blinked.
"Well, I suppose it could."
"Anyway, go on. Sorry to interrupt."
"But that's it. She sees a door, and then blank. Without Crystal's help, she could only go so far. We think he left the office and drove out to the beach house as usual, only something went terribly wrong. Of course, Crystal denies this. She claims he never arrived, but we only have her word for it."
"So you think she knows where he is and she's covering?"
"Well, yes," she said, as though surprised I'd ask. "Nancy can feel his presence. She gets the strong impression he's been hurt. He's definitely surrounded by darkness. She says he's trying to reach us, but something's holding him back."
"He's alive?"
"She's sure he's alive. She's very clear about that. However, she says there are some very negative forces at work. She says he's distressed because he doesn't know where he is. He's encompassed by this oppressive spiritual consciousness.
She can feel his confusion, but that's as much as she gets. Nancy says Crystal's very connected to Daddy's plight. In fact, she probably caused it.
How?
Well, she could have knocked him out and driven him away somewhere.
And done what with his car? I don't mean to argue. I'm genuinely puzzled.
There could have been two of them. She could have hired someone. How do I know? I'm just telling you, nothing would suit her better than to have him out of the way.
Why? I mean, just for the sake of argument. Let's say she had him kidnapped and he's been held against his will. What's her motive? Can't be money. There hasn't been a ransom note and no contact from anyone offering to make a deal.
Blanche leaned forward. Listen, before she married my father, she signed a prenuptial agreement, according to which she gets absolutely nothing if they divorce.
Wait a minute, back up.
You still haven't told me how she intends to profit if she had him snatched.
I didn't say she had him kidnapped. I said she knows where he is.
What's that have to do with a prenup?
She's been having an affair.
Your mother mentioned that as well. This is Clint Augustine?
Exactly. Now she wants her freedom, but she wants the money, too. If she tries to divorce him, she'll end up with nothing. The only way she benefits is if Daddy dies.
Which, according to Nancy, he hasn't done yet.
That's right.
Why would she risk anything as blatant as an affair with her personal trainer? Wouldn't word get out?
He was her personal trainer. He's not now. Once she started screwing him, I guess they decided to discontinue the public aspects of their relationship. The rumors started flying in any event.
How did you find out?
From Mother's friend, Dana Glazer. She and her husband have a house in Horton Ravine. Joel's one of Daddy's
employers. Yes, I heard about that.
The Glazer property backs right up to Daddy's, with just a little fence in between. They have a guest cottage back there, and Crystal asked if they'd consider renting it temporarily to a friend of hers. She claimed he'd bought a house he had to renovate, and the work wouldn't be finished until early fall. This was back in January. Anyway, the Glazers don't use the cottage, so they decided, hey, why not? They asked $800 a month, and the guy never batted an eye. Of course, once Dana realized what was going on, she was horrified. She found it thoroughly repulsive, which is why she hated having to tell my mom.
Why'd she tell you?
She didn't. I heard it from another friend. Dana confirmed the story, but only because I pressed.
Believe me, I don't gossip. A lot of people don't. It doesn't seem to stop them from passing stuff on. Why didn't Dana evict him if she found the situation so repellent?
Because he'd signed a 6-month lease. He's gone now, and good riddance. You're welcome to talk to her if you don't believe me.
I mean, Dana ought to know. It happened right under her nose.
Poor mother. She still thinks Daddy's coming back to her. Bad enough he left her for such a tart, but the fact that Crystal's still doing it makes Daddy look like a fool.
Which leads us to what conclusion?
Crystal wants him dead. She wants him out of the way.
She said with the first flash of feeling I'd seen in her. Her mouth trembled and she began to blink rapidly. She looked off toward the hallway, taking a moment to compose herself. Under her maternity tunic, I saw a knot move across her lap, probably the baby's foot. I could see why people reached out impulsively to lay a hand on such a belly. Blanche directed her comments to the far side of the room.
Believe me, she married Daddy for his money. The prenup was just a ploy. She might have meant it at the time, but then she ran into Clint and got involved with him. Like I said, if Daddy dies, she inherits the bulk of his estate, and then she's home free. If she divorces him, she gets nothing. It's as simple as that.
Blanche, you don't know for a fact your father's dead. None of us know that. Even your friend Nancy claims he's still alive. Blanche's gaze swung back to mine, her blue eyes ablaze.
Don't say even Nancy like she's a charlatan. I resent that.
Not my intention. I withdraw the word. The point is, she has an image of him helpless, but alive, at least from what you say.
But for how long? The man's nearly 70 years old. What if he's tied up? What if he's gagged and can't breathe?
All right. Let me see what I can do to check it out. So far, this is pure theory. But I can appreciate the worry. The minute I got home, I went to my desk and began taking notes, writing down the list of possibilities for Dowan Purcell's fate. I dismissed the notion that he'd been kidnapped, but maybe I was wrong. He might have been forcibly removed and carted off somewhere, in which case he was either dead, sorry, Nance, or being held against his will. I detailed the other options, writing them down as quickly as they occurred to me. He could have left voluntarily, departing of his own accord, on the run or hiding out. He could have met with an accident while driving under the influence. If he was lying at the bottom of a canyon, it would certainly explain the fact that his Mercedes hadn't been spotted yet. He could have been subject to any one of a number of fatal incidents. Aneurysm, heart attack, stroke. If so, it was puzzling that no one had stumbled across the body. But it sometimes happens that way. Or what? He could have established a secret life, having slipped from one persona into the next. What else? Fearing disgrace, he could have killed himself. Or, as Blanche suggested, someone could have killed him for gain, or to cover something worse. I couldn't think of any other permutations. Well, two. Amnesia. Though that felt like an old 30s movie plot. Or he might have been assaulted by a mugger who overplayed his hand and then disposed of the body. The only other possibility was his having been arrested and jailed. But according to Detective Odessa, Purcell hadn't shown up in any law enforcement computer system. From this, I surmised that he hadn't been identified as the perpetrator of his own crimes or the victim of anyone else's. I studied the list. There were certain variations I had no way to pursue. For instance, if Dow had been taken ill, if he'd been injured or killed in a fatal accident, I had no way to know unless someone stepped forward with information. The cops had already canvassed hospitals in the area. This was one of those times when being a small-town private investigator, and a lone operator on top of that, made the job difficult. I had no access to airline, immigration, or customs records, so I couldn't determine if Purcell had boarded a plane, or a train, or a boat, in his name or someone else's, using a fake driver's license and a fake passport. If he were still in this country, he might well evade notice as long as he didn't use his credit cards, didn't rent or buy property, didn't apply for a telephone or utilities, didn't drive with expired tags, or in any other way attract attention to himself or his vehicle. He couldn't vote, couldn't do work that required his true social security number, couldn't open a bank account. He certainly couldn't practice medicine, which is how he earned a living for the past 40 years. Of course, if he'd cooked up a false identity, he could do as he pleased as long as his story was plausible and his bona fides checked out. If this were the case, finding him would be next to impossible after only 9 weeks. There simply hadn't been enough time for his name to surface in the records. My only hope was to plod my way systematically from friend to friend, colleague to associate, current wife to ex, daughter to daughter, in hopes of a lead. All I needed was one tiny snag in the fabric of his life, one loop or tear that I might use to unravel his current whereabouts. I decided to focus on the areas over which I had control. Sunday went by in a blur. I gave myself the day off and spent the time puttering around my apartment taking care of minor chores. Monday morning, I got up as usual, pulled on my sweats and my sockinies, and did a 3-mile jog. The cloud cover was dense and the surf was a muddy brown. The rain had eased, but the sidewalks were still wet, and I splashed through shallow puddles as I ran the 1.5 miles to the bathhouse, where I did the turnaround. The earthworms had emerged and lay strewn across the sidewalk like lengths of gray string from an old floor mop. The path was also littered with snails traversing the walk, with all the optimism of the innocent. I had to watch where I stepped to keep from crushing them. Back at my place, I picked up my gym bag and headed over to the gym. I parked my car in the only space available, tucked between a pickup truck and a late-model van. Even from the parking lot, I could hear the clank of machines,
the grunts of a powerlifter straining with a deadlift. Inside, the rock and roll music coming in through the speakers competed with a morning news show airing on the ceiling-mounted TV set. Two women on the stair machines climbed patiently, while a third woman and two men trotted smartly on treadmills set at double speed. All five sets of eyes were focused on the screen. I signed in, idly asking Keith at the desk if he knew Clint Augustine. Keith's in his 20s with a busy brown mustache and a gleaming shaven head. He said, "Sure, I know Clint. You've probably seen him in here. Big guy, white blonde hair. He usually works out at 5 o'clock when the place first opens up. Sometimes he comes in later with his clients, mostly married chicks. They're a specialty of his." Keith's intermittent use of steroids caused him to swell and shrink according to his consumption. He was currently in shrunken form, which I personally preferred. He was one of those guys with a great chest and biceps, but very little in the way of lower body development. Maybe he figured because he stood behind a counter, he didn't need to buff out anything below his waist. I heard he's been working with Crystal Purcell. He did for a while. They'd come in late afternoon, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Isn't she the wife of the guy who disappeared a while back? Man, that's a tough one. Something skanky going on there. Could be, I said. Anyway, I gotta get a move on. Thanks for the info.
Sure thing.
I pulled on my workout gloves and found a quiet spot. I stretched out on a gray mat and started with my ab routine. 2 sets of 50 sit-ups, hands behind my head, my bent legs resting on a free weight bench. I could smell glue fumes wafting through the asphalt gray carpeting. The Nautilus and Universal machines looked like elaborate constructions built from a full-size erector set. Metal verticals, bolts, pulleys, angled joints. Once I finished my sit-ups, I started with leg curls, the exercise I most despise. While I counted 15 reps, I pictured my hamstrings popping loose and rolling up like window shades. I moved on to leg extensions, which burned like hell, but at least didn't threaten any crippling side effects. Back, chest, and shoulders. I finished my workout with preacher curls and dumbbell curls. I saved the best machine for last. Triceps extensions, always a favorite of mine. I left the gym damp with perspiration. Home again, I showered, pulled on a turtleneck, jeans, and my boots, grabbed a bite of breakfast, and packed myself a brown bag lunch. I reached the office at 9 o'clock and put a call through to the police department, where Detective Odessa assured me he'd do yet another computer check to see if there was any sign of Dow Purcell. He'd already sorted through numerous bulletins, describing the unidentified dead throughout the state. There were no Caucasian males in Purcell's age range. Local police, sheriff's department, and CHP officers were being briefed weekly on the importance of keeping an eye out for him. Odessa had increased his coverage, papering most of the medical facilities in the surrounding counties in case Purcell showed up incoherent or comatose. I briefed him on the people I'd spoken to so far. When I told him about the issue of Medicare fraud, he said,
"Yeah, we know that."
"Well, why didn't you tell me?"
"Because it's Paglia's call and we're under orders from him."
By the end of the conversation, it was clear we were both still in the dark, though he did seem to appreciate my bringing him up to date. He was even moderately charitable about Blanche's consulting a psychic, which surprised me somehow. I forget that police detectives, in addition to being hard-assed, are also capable of entertaining doubts about such things. I pulled out the phone number for Jacob Trigg, whose name Crystal had given me, saying he was Dow's best friend. I dialed and spoke briefly to him, explaining who I was, and we set up an appointment for 10 o'clock Tuesday morning at his place. I made a note on my calendar, and then called Joel Glazer at the office number Crystal had given me. His secretary told me he was working from home and gave me the phone number there so I could reach him. I called the number, briefly identified myself and the fact that Fiona had hired me. He seemed pleasant and cooperative to the extent that he gave me his address and set up a meeting for 1 o'clock that afternoon. I then called Santa Teresa Hospital and learned that Penelope Delacorte was now Director of Nursing Services, in her office from 9 to 5 weekdays. I made a note of the title and decided to try her later in the day after my meeting with Glazer. Lastly, on my own behalf, I made a call to Richard Hevener, whose machine picked up. I left a message inquiring about the status of my rental application. I tried to sound especially winsome on the phone, in hopes that might tip the odds in my favor. At lunchtime, I sat at my desk and ate the peanut butter and pickle sandwich I'd brought from home. At 12:30, I left the building and started walking around the block, hoping I'd remember where I parked my car. I found the VW unmolested at the corner of Capillo and Olivio, much closer than I'd thought, and in the opposite direction. For the fifth day straight, the sky was overcast, a brooding gray roiling at the edges where a thick mass of clouds threatened rain. Santa Teresa is constrained on the north by the mountains and on the south by the Pacific Ocean, limiting geographic growth. The westernmost neighborhoods feather out as far as Colgate, the easternmost sweeping into Montebello, where the prices jump. Horton Ravine, where I was headed, is a moneyed enclave carved out by land grant and deed, whereby successive California governors rewarded military leaders for killing people really, really well. The resulting 3,000-plus acres were passed from rich man to richer, until the last in line, a sheep rancher named Tobias Horton, had the good sense to subdivide the land into saleable lots, thus making a killing of another kind. I took the 101 as far as the La Cuesta off-ramp, turned left, and followed the road around to the right, heading for the main entrance, which consisted of two massive stone pillars with Horton Ravine spelled out in curlicue wrought iron arching between them. The ravine was lush, the trunks of sycamores and live oaks stained dark from the recent rains. Most of the roads are called Via something, Via being the Spanish word for way or road. I drove past the Horton Ravine Riding Club, continued a mile, and finally took a right turn and went up a hill. The Glazers lived on Via Bueno, Road Good, if I remember rightly from my brief matriculation in night school Spanish. The house was 1960s modern, a dazzling white cluster of abstract forms superimposed on one another in what amounted to an architectural pig pile. Three soaring stories were variously angled and cantilevered, with a steeply pitched tower driving straight up out of the center of the mass. There were wide decks on all sides and large expanses of glass, into which birds probably regularly propelled themselves and died. When I'd first met Dana Jaffe, she was living in a small housing tract in the town of Perdido, 30 miles to the south. I wondered if she was as conscious as I of how far she'd come. I parked in a circular motor court and crossed to the low, sweeping stairs that led up to the front door. A few minutes passed, and then she answered the bell. I could have sworn she was wearing the same outfit I'd seen her in the first time we'd met. Tight, faded jeans and a plain white T-shirt. Her hair was still the color of honey, with silver, as fine as silk threads now appearing in the mix. She'd had it cut and layered, every strand falling into place as she moved her head. Her eyes were khaki or hazel, sometimes reflecting green, sometimes brown under softly feathered brows. Her most arresting feature was her mouth. Her teeth were slightly occluded, and the overbite made her lips appear plump and pouty. She said, "Hello, Kinsey. Joel said you'd be stopping by. Please come in. Let me take that." "This is beautiful," I said as I stepped inside, slipping off my slicker, which I handed to her. While she hung it in the closet, I had time to gape. The interior was cathedral-like, a vast space crowned by a vaulted ceiling 30 feet above. Bridges and catwalks connected the irregular levels of the house, and shafts of sunlight formed geometric patterns on the smooth stone floor. Dana joined me, saying, "Fiona probably told you we are redoing the place." "She mentioned that," I said. "She also said you suggested me for this job, which I appreciate." "You're entirely welcome. I confess I didn't like you back then, but you did seem honest and persistent, a regular little terrier when it came to finding Wendell. Your friend, Mac Voorhees, at California Fidelity, gives you the credit for the fact I got to keep the money." "I've wondered about that. Last I heard, they were still debating the issue. I'm glad it worked out. How well did you know Dow?" "I ran into him occasionally because of Joel.